content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the December 1st, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week has former President Bill Clinton in the foreground in his usual blue suit and red tie, kind of looking down, maybe a little bit of a pensive look on his face. And in the background are three women. One of them's pointing at him. And the title says, "The Reckoning. Did Democrats wrongly defend a sexual predator?" And we'll get to that story on the controversy of the week, but we'll start as usual with the main stories. Sexual harassment spotlight shifts to Congress. What happened? The wave of sexual harassment allegations against powerful men has swept into Congress after a woman accused Democratic Senator Al Franken of groping and forcibly kissing her 11 years ago. Leanne Tweeden, a local radio show host, said last week that the former Saturday Night Live writer stuck his tongue in my mouth while they rehearsed backstage during a USO tour to entertain troops in 2006, 3 years before Franken joined the Senate. She said she pushed him away, feeling violated and disgusted. Tweeden also released a photo from the flight home from that tour in which Franken appears to grope her breast while grinning at the camera. The Minnesota Democrat said he remembered the backstage incident differently, but apologized to Tweeden, saying he felt ashamed. A second woman, Lindsay Mintz, accused the senator of groping her buttock while they posed for a photo at a state fair in 2010. He said he had no recollection of the incident. Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell condemned Franken's behavior and called for a Senate Ethics Committee investigation. President Trump, who came out in support of alleged child molester Roy Moore in the U.S. Senate race in Alabama, chided Franken on Twitter, calling him Al Frankenstein. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said there was a very clear distinction between Franken and Trump, who was accused of sexual misconduct by more than a dozen women during the election. Senator Franken has admitted wrongdoing, she said. President hasn't. Trump has insisted all of his accusers are lying. In other developments, BuzzFeed.com revealed that Michigan Representative John Conyers, the top Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, paid one of his former staffers a secret $27,000 settlement in 2015 after she said he fired her for rejecting his advances. Conyers, 88, denies her claim of harassment. In the media world, CBS and PBS fired longtime anchor Charlie Rose, 75, after eight women accused him of unwanted sexual advances. What the editorial said, Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey are pariahs. Roy Moore and Al Franken are under fire. Charlie Rose is history. This may be the dawn of a new era, said the Chicago Tribune, one in which powerful men know that if they engage in sexual harassment and abuse, they'll be toast. This national reckoning, however, has bypassed President Trump, who was caught on videotape bragging about groping women and was credibly accused of multiple sexual assaults. The pass he got from voters may be responsible for the remarkable transformation now in progress. Women sickened by his election, it seems, have decided to stand up against their own abusers. We are now confronting a systemic problem, said the Washington Examiner. In every industry, men in power abuse their position to molest women. The first step is changing our culture is to hold our leaders accountable and not defend those in our own party, the way Democrats did during President Clinton's sex scandals. Men must teach their sons to treat women with dignity and respect, and men in power must learn to see power as a constraint, not a license to harass and exploit women. What the columnist said. Franken has to resign, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon.com. The only realistic way to stop sexual harassment is to ensure that men face consequences for engaging in it. If Franken remains in the Senate, he'll become a visible symbol of liberal hypocrisy. By punting Franken's fate to the feckless Senate Ethics Committee for a likely wrist slap, Democrats are handing Republicans a three-word weapon, said Kyle Smith in NationalReview.com. What about Franken? Liberals won't be able to demand punishment for any Republican over sexual harassment until he goes, not even Roy Moore. Sure, it's unfair to equate Franken's unwanted kiss and feigned photo grope with Moore's serial predations on teenage girls, but politics isn't fair. That's why I have second thoughts about calling on Franken to resign, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. Liberal-leaning fields like Hollywood, media, and the Democratic Party have quickly forced out their harassers because progressives committed to gender equality won't tolerate sexism and abuse even from our allies. But if we make an example of Franken while Trump and many other Republicans rally around Moore, would we be unilaterally disarming and giving more power to the Republicans who want to take women's rights away? Another risk is overcompensating for earlier apathy, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Franken's behavior was more boorish than predatory, and he wasn't Tweeden's boss. Does an otherwise good and decent man deserve to lose his career over behavior not remotely comparable to Weinstein's or Moore's? Not all crimes deserve the death penalty. Continuing in a similar vein, the controversy of the week is indeed about Bill Clinton, an overdue reckoning. What about Bill, said Peter Barker in the New York Times. For more than a year, since the first of more than a dozen allegations of sexual assault against now President Trump, conservatives have been calling liberals hypocrites for refusing to confront the sins of their own predator president, William Jefferson Clinton. This week, that reckoning may finally have begun. With every hour seeming to bring new revelations of harassment by powerful men in politics and the media, a host of contrite liberal pundits second-guessed their defenses of Clinton during the impeachment battle. In hindsight, we got it wrong, said Matt Iglesias in Vox.com. In the 1990s, there really was a well-funded right-wing effort to bring down President Clinton. And too many liberals took that as license to dismiss three women's stories of his sexually abusive behavior, including a credible accusation of rape from Juanita Broderick. Clinton's affair with Lewinsky, though consensual, was an egregious case of workplace sexual misconduct by a powerful man. We should have held Clinton accountable back then, forcing him to resign in shame, making a strong statement about men's abuse of power for sexual gain. Instead, by putting politics above principle, as Republicans are doing today with Trump and Senate candidate Roy Moore, we blew it. What convenient timing, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. Our progressive friends have discovered their consciences about Bill Clinton at the precise moment the Clintons ceased to be useful instruments of political power. They hope that with a few crocodile tears, they can regain the moral high ground and make conservatives look like the hypocrites and villains of the abuse scandal sweeping the nation. Don't let them fool you. The left's belated admission that Clinton was a predator is driven as much by political calculus as was their willful blindness back in 1998. It takes no courage to speak up 20 years after it could have made a difference, said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com. This isn't a reckoning as much as it is a face-saving. Actually, this sudden revisionism is inconveniently late for Democrats, said Josh Barrow in BusinessInsider.com. If they were really thinking tactically, they should have pressured Bill Clinton to resign back in 1998, handing the White House to Vice President Al Gore. Not only would Gore have pursued an agenda identical to Clinton's, he would have fought the 2000 election, a race he ended up losing by the slimmest of margins, with all the advantages of an incumbent. Better still, it would have brought down the Clinton dynasty, meaning someone other than Hillary Clinton would likely have been the nominee in 2016. Sticking by Bill Clinton in the 90s, in short, cost the Democrats not one, but two presidential elections, which in moral terms is probably just what they deserved. It's time to stop thinking of sexual abuse in tactical partisan terms, said Maureen Dowd in the New York Times. Both Democrats and Republicans have sought to exploit their opponents' harassment scandals for ideological ends, while vigorously defending their own predators, whose ranks have included both Clinton and Trump. The truth, we now know, is that sexual abuse is a bipartisan scourge, said Andrew Sullivan in NYMag.com. If we can overcome the tribalism that poisons our public life and hold our leaders accountable for their behavior regardless of their party affiliation, it would not only be a long overdue turning point for women, it would be a watershed for us all. On a somewhat lighter note, we'll take in the Good Week, Bad Week feature. It was a good week for vegans after researchers at Oregon State University announced they've created a new strain of seaweed that has three times the nutritional value of kale and allegedly tastes like bacon when cooked. It was a good week for means testing when Norwegian college student Katarina Anderson was fined $30,400 for driving under the influence. Traffic fines are pegged to the defendant's income in Norway, where Anderson, 22, an heiress, is the country's richest woman, worth an estimated $1.23 billion. And it was a good week for strap hangers after New York City subway officials said they would no longer use the word momentarily in announcing delays. Sometimes momentarily means 2 minutes, said subway rider Judith Mosh. Sometimes it means 20 minutes. But it was a bad week for fish, who can experience human-like emotions, including depression, marine biologists say. Depressed people are withdrawn, said biologist Cullum Brown. The same is true of fish. It was a bad week for Hasbro after it apologized for a pro-Trump message on a new Transformers toy. Four tiny symbols on the side of the toy spell out M-A-G-A, Make America Great Again, in a special Transformers alphabet. Hasbro said one of its vendors inserted the letters without authorization. And it was a bad week for fake news, with a new internet claim that a photo from the 1972 Apollo 17 mission shows the reflection in an astronaut's visor of a stagehand standing on the moon without a spacesuit. You be the judge, said Fox News, tweeting a link to the story. Moving to the briefing page, China's strongman president. Xi Jinping is China's most powerful leader in decades. What are his plans for the country and the world? How much control does Xi have? The president has accumulated more power than any Chinese leader since Mao Zedong. He has almost total control of the Communist Party, which in turn has almost total control of the country's 1.4 billion people. His image is plastered all over the nation, on posters, billboards, and TV screens in busy plazas, leading some critics to claim Xi is building a personality cult. At the Communist Party Congress last month, Xi, age 64, was elected to a second five-year term as president, but he avoided designating a successor, raising suspicions that he might break with tradition and try to stay in office indefinitely. During the Congress, his political philosophy, Xi Jinping thought, was enshrined in the party's constitution. Only one other leader, Mao, has been honored in such a way while still alive. Asked to name China's five most powerful people, Jeff Wasserstrom, a China expert at the University of California, told CNN, Xi, 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 and Xi. Where did he come from? The son of a revolutionary leader who fell out of favor with Mao, Xi was sent to the countryside at age 15 for re-education during the Cultural Revolution. Xi spent 7 years living in a cave home but survived the upheaval by embracing the party. He became redder than red, said a Chinese academic who knew him as a young man. Xi climbed the ranks and in 2012 was chosen as party leader, just as officials were growing nervous about their hold on the people. Party bigwigs were alarmed by the so-called color revolutions in former Soviet republics and by the Arab Spring uprisings and feared that Chinese citizens might also take to the streets. They had plenty to protest. Revelations that some officials had looted state resources to the tune of billions of dollars were ricocheting through still new social media networks. Waving the banner of anti-corruption, Xi had thousands of officials arrested. The purge destroyed his rival's power bases, giving him nearly total control of the party. How did he use that power? To prevent a democratic groundswell, Xi shut down civil society organizations and rounded up human rights lawyers and bloggers. He then cemented his authority by appointing allies to key posts. The seven-member Politburo Standing Committee, the nation's top political body, is stuffed with his cronies. Technology has given Xi and the party new Big Brother-like control over the lives of ordinary Chinese. Practically everyone in the country is under surveillance through WeChat, a super app with 1 billion accounts. Users do everything through the app, pay bills, schedule doctor's appointments, post photos, apply for jobs. Conversations on WeChat are automatically censored. Any reference to a sensitive topic such as Tiananmen Square or Tibet is blocked. Starting in 2020, the party will assign each citizen a social credit score based on data culled from WeChat and other apps that will determine their eligibility for a mortgage, whether they can travel abroad, and more. What are his economic policies? Xi is not a reformer. The party has always had a large presence in state-owned enterprises, but that control has become more explicit under Xi. Most companies have a party committee, and at the big state oil companies, telecom firms, and weapons manufacturers, the head of that committee is now also the chairman of the board. Most major foreign companies in China operate through joint ventures with state enterprises, and Xi has been pushing for more party control in these as well. But it's doubtful increased centralization will sustain economic growth. While the economy expanded rapidly over the past three decades, averaging 10% growth a year, it started to slow in 2015. Bloated state industries are now being propped up by nearly unlimited loans from state-owned banks. Does he have a foreign policy vision? China should take center stage in the world, Xi said at the Party Congress, and he hasn't been shy about advancing his country's leadership abroad. Since he took office, China has aggressively asserted its claim over much of the contested South China Sea, building artificial islands bristling with military bases. Xi's One Belt, One Road plan involves more than $1 trillion being spent on infrastructure projects, including ports, railroads, and highways across Asia, Africa, and Europe, expanding China's trade and military reach. Yet Xi has sought to present an ascendant China not as a threat to the U.S., but as an equal partner. The Chinese leader wooed President Trump during his recent trip to Beijing, showering him with pomp and spectacle in an attempt to get Trump to back off his criticism of China's trade policy. The strategy appeared to work, with Trump telling Xi, "We have great chemistry. I think we'll do tremendous things." Can one man rule work in China? Chinese governance used to operate on consensus, rule by committee, a system imposed after Mao's unchecked dictatorship led to the slaughter and chaos of the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. But Xi's total control of the party and ruthless purging of rivals means other officials are now afraid to speak out against bad policies, a dangerous development considering China's key role in the showdown over North Korea's nuclear weapons program and its crucial role in the global economy. There could be an emperor's new clothes situation, said Zhang Lifan, a Chinese historian and critic of the government. If there is a crisis in the future, he might not get the necessary information. Time now for a few columns. The first from the U.S., Michael Tomosky at thedailybeast.com writes, "The bogus stories that millions believe." If you want to know just how much trouble we're in as a country, said Michael Tomosky, all you need to do is visit Snopes.com, S-N-O-P-E-S.com. The website, founded in 1995 to fact-check urban legends, is largely devoted today to debunking fake news, utterly bogus stories that circulate on Facebook and fringe websites and are believed by millions of people. One recent Snopes story, for example, examined the question, was the Texas church shooter an Antifa member who vowed to start a civil war? He was not, but on right-wing websites, the fringe lefty group is depicted as a massive movement working to overthrow the government and enslave God-fearing Americans. Another much-shared story that Snopes debunked relied on a doctored photo that showed one of those ungrateful black NFL players burning an American flag in the locker room, an event that didn't happen. Every day, Americans who shun the mainstream media are taken in by doctored photos, conspiracy theories, and phony stories concocted by a mix of partisan propagandists and pranksters who enjoy stoking their outrage. Another 5 or 10 years of this, and we'll have a class of millions of citizens who get news only from fake sources. This column comes from Germany. Easterners feel like they've been colonized. Do we need affirmative action for East Germans? Asks Marita Adam-Dalek. Nearly three decades after the Berlin Wall fell, East Germans, or OSIS, still feel they are living in a colony, with West German overlords running their governments and businesses. Just look at what happened in Saxony. A former East German uranium mine, which employed some 45,000 people in its bloated communist inefficiency, was transformed after Germany reunified in 1990 into a modern productive facility. But only 1,000 of the workers were retained for the new mine, and now unemployment in the state is over 20%. Nor were former communist bureaucrats given positions in the new administrations. The Westerners feared a communist taint, so police chiefs and regulators all came from the West. Today, 75% of the department heads in the ministries of former East German states are Westerners. Not a single rector of a state university is an OC. No wonder so many East Germans backed the xenophobic far-right Alternative for Germany party in the September elections. They were already furious about foreigners before the country took in any refugees. A quota system for hiring OSIS is a distasteful thought. It would seem humiliating, but does anyone have a better idea? And this from Zimbabwe. Army takeover ends Mugabe's reign. Zimbabweans are cheering the downfall of a despot, said the Sunday Mail from Zimbabwe. President Robert Mugabe, 93, the only leader Zimbabwe has known since independence in 1980, was effectively stripped of his powers after our patriotic military took action last week to cleanse the ruling ZANU-PF party of corrupt elements. The intervention, which is not a coup, is wildly popular. Over the weekend, Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, was a sea of singing and dancing people from across political persuasions who all had one call, national renewal. This week, ZANU-PF officials expelled Mugabe from the party, and since he stubbornly refused to resign as president, they started impeachment proceedings. The president's overambitious wife was his ruin, said the Standard from Zimbabwe in an editorial. Grace Mugabe, a former typist turned combative first lady, led a young faction of the ZANU-PF and was intent on succeeding her husband. But Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa, a 75-year-old Liberation War hero who is popular with the military, considered himself Mugabe's rightful successor. Mugabe's fatal mistake was to try to cement 52-year-old Grace's succession by firing Mnangagwa earlier this month and then ordering the arrest of a top general, Constantino Chiwenga. That was a step too far for the military, who arrested Mugabe instead. Grace's unpopularity, she is known as Gucci Grace or Disgrace for her lavish lifestyle, made the army's efforts to win over Zimbabweans' hearts a very easy task. Mugabe didn't start out as a greedy authoritarian, said Wanga Zangaza in the Zimbabwe Independent. In the 1960s and 70s, he bravely fought against white minority rule. And in the decade after he took power, Mugabe transformed Zimbabwe for the better, offering free education and health care, as well as a reliable social welfare system that provided a safety net to millions. Literacy soared and child mortality plummeted. But around 2000, Mugabe ceased to be a man of the people. His violent land reform program devastated the agricultural sector as his cronies confiscated white-owned farms, ostensibly to be redistributed to the poor, but more often shared among the party elite. A decree that foreign firms must cede to local ownership caused investment to flee. Now Zimbabwe, once Africa's breadbasket and a manufacturing power, has food shortages and 90% unemployment. No wonder we're cheering the military. But the military has been complicit in Mugabe's crime, said Zimbabwean opposition leader David Coltart in South Africa's Daily Maverick.co.za. Soldiers spearheaded the violence after the disputed elections in 2008 and 2013, murdering hundreds of opposition supporters to ensure Mugabe's return to power. The military is now detaining Grace and her top aides. And while the army's action is popular, it's illegal. Zimbabweans must unite in demanding that the military now step back. Mnangagwa will presumably take over as president, but there is an election coming up next year. Will the army stay out of it? And it's time now for the last word, our in-depth article. It's titled this week, Where Trump's Support Endures. In a struggling former steel town that voted for President Trump, residents don't blame him for failing to revive their communities or make good on other promises, said journalist Michael Cruz. They love him anyway. Pam Schilling is the reason Donald Trump is the president. Schilling's personal story is, in poignant miniature, the story of this area in western Pennsylvania as a whole, one of the long-forgotten woe-begone spots in the middle of the country that gave Trump his unexpected victory last fall. She grew up in nearby Nanty Glow, the daughter and granddaughter of coal miners. She once had a union job packing meat at a grocery store and then had to settle for less money at Walmart. Now she's 60 and retired, and last year in April, her 32-year-old son died of a heroin overdose. Desperate for change, Schilling, like so many other once reliable Democrats in these parts, responded enthusiastically to what Trump was saying, building a wall on the Mexican border, repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, bringing back jobs and stealing coal. That's what Trump told them. At a raucous rally in late October, right downtown in their minor league hockey arena, he vowed to restore the mines and the mills that had been the lifeblood of the region until they started closing some 40 years ago. When Trump won, people here were ecstatic, but they'd heard generations of politicians make big promise before, and they were also impatient for him to deliver. 6 months to a year, catering company owner Joey Del Senor told me when we met days after the election. A couple of months, retired nurse Maggie Freer said, before saying it might take a couple of years. He's just got to follow through with what he said he was going to do, Schilling said last November. Back then, there was an all but audible, or else. A year later, the local unemployment rate has ticked down, and activity in a few coal mines has ticked up. Beyond that, though, not much has changed, at least not for the better. Johnstown and the surrounding region are struggling in the same ways and for the same reasons. The drug problem is just as bad. There's nothing good in the area, Schilling said the other day in her living room. Even so, her backing for Trump is utterly undiminished. I'm a supporter of him 100%. What I heard from Schilling is overwhelmingly what I heard in my follow-up conversations with people here, whom I talked to last year as well. Over the course of 3 days this month, I revisited the president's base, that 30-plus percent of the electorate who resolutely approve of the job he is doing. But what I wasn't prepared for was how readily these same people had abandoned the contract he had made with them. Their satisfaction with Trump now seems untethered to the things he once said mattered to them most. I don't know that he has done a lot to help, Freer told me. Last year she said she wouldn't vote for him again if he didn't do what he said he was going to do. Last week she matter-of-factly stated that she would. Support Trump? Sure, she said. I like him. When I asked Del Senor about the past year here, he said he didn't see any change because we got a new president. He nonetheless remains an ardent proponent. He's our answer. I asked Schilling what would happen if the next 3 years go the way the past one has. I'm not going to blame him, Schilling said. Absolutely not. Is there anything that could change your mind about Trump? Nope, she said. All this, perhaps, is not so surprising, considering polling continues to show that, in spite of his unprecedented unpopularity, nearly all people who voted for Trump would do it again. But as I compared this year's answers to last year's, it seemed clear that the basis of people's support had morphed. Johnstown voters do not intend to hold the president accountable for the non-negotiable pledges he made to them. It's not that the people who made Trump president have generously moved the goalposts for him. It's that they have eliminated the goalposts altogether. This reality ought to get the attention of anyone who thinks they will win in 2018 or 2020 by running against Trump's record. His supporters here, it turns out, are energized by his bombast and his animus more than any actual accomplishments. For them, it's evidently not what he's doing so much as it is the people he's fighting. Trump is simply and unceasingly angry on their behalf, battling the people who vex them the worst, obstructionist Democrats, uncooperative establishment Republicans, the media, Black Lives Matter protesters, and NFL players. Boy, oh boy, do they hate kneeling NFL players, whom they see as ungrateful, disrespectful millionaires. And they love him for this. Del Señor, by his own admission, is not a person who's focused on policy specifics. A short, stout, genial man who wears gold chains around his neck and rings on both pinkies, he last year did something for Trump he had never done for any other candidate. The 61-year-old Johnstown native proudly planted a Trump sign in the ground in front of his catering company. And nothing that's happened in the past 12 months has lessened his enthusiasm for the man who so energized him. Everybody I talk to, he said, realizes it's not Trump who's dragging his feet. Trump's probably the most diligent, hardest-working president we've ever had in our lifetimes. It's not like he sleeps in till noon and goes golfing every weekend, like the last president did. I stopped him, informing him that, yes, Barack Obama liked to golf, but Trump, in fact, does golf a lot, too. More, in fact. Del Señor was surprised to hear this. Does he? He said. Yes, I said. He did not linger on this topic, smiling and changing the subject with a quip. If I was married to his wife, Del Señor said, I don't think I'd go anywhere. A little more than a month after last year's election, a five-month-old baby starved to death in her bassinet after both her parents overdosed on fentanyl, a frighteningly potent sort of synthetic heroin. It was shocking, even to a community that's become all too familiar with the unremitting ravages of opioids. There are some positives around here. Corsa Coal's Acosta Mine in neighboring Somerset County opened in June. So did Robindale Energy's new Maple Springs Mine. Rosebud Mining reportedly is working to reopen its facility in Crescent. The area's unemployment rate stands at 5.2%, down a point from last year, but still higher than the state national numbers. At Johnstown's JWF Industries, a 450-employee manufacturing company, business hasn't gone up this year, owner Bill Polichek told me, but he's expecting a 30% jump next year. He chalks that up to Trump and his pro-business mood. But even this optimistic stance highlights some of the deep-seated troubles here. Right now, if I could find 150 people, I'd put them to work, Polichek said. He needs machinists and welders. But it's hard to find people, he said. People with skills, people who can pass a drug test. Something I heard last week that I didn't hear last year, resignation. Drapes drawn, Freer, the retired nurse, sat in her living room and told me there really wasn't all that much Trump could do to help Johnstown and Cambria County. You know, we're sort of a depressed area, she said. We're just a little area, you know, but it's a good area, good people here. And I think he would if he knew of a place that had a lot of problems. I think he would try to help. I don't know what he could do or would want to do for Johnstown, you know. He said he was going to bring back the steel mills. You're never going to get those steel mills back, she said. But he said he was going to, I said. Yeah, but how's he going to bring them back? I don't know, I said. But it's what he said last year, and people voted up for him because of it. They always say they want to bring the steel mills back, Freer said. But they're going to have to do a lot of work to bring the steel mills back. He hasn't built the wall yet either. I don't care about his wall, said Freer, 76. I mean, if he gets his wall, I don't give a blank, you know. But he has a good idea. Keep him out. He also hasn't repealed Obamacare. That's Congress, she said. And the drug scourge here continues unabated. And it's not going to improve for a long time, she said, until people learn, which they won't. But I like him, Freer reiterated, because he does what he says. One afternoon, I stopped to talk to a small group of people who had gathered on the sidewalk across the street from Johnstown Planned Parenthood office. Gail Bala sat on a low rock wall and held a sign that said, "Abortion kills children." She voted for Obama in 2008. She voted for Romney in 2012. Her parents were Democrats. Her steelworker husband was a Democrat, and she was a Democrat until 2 years ago. She voted for Trump last fall, and she'll definitely vote for him in 2022. He's kind of the last best hope, in my opinion, said Bala, 65, a retired high school Spanish and reading teacher. I haven't run into anybody who said they'd never vote for him again. Next to Bala was a gray-haired man who told me he voted for Trump and was happy so far because he's kept his promises. I asked which ones. Border security, but there's no wall yet. No fault of his, the man said. What else? Getting rid of Obamacare. But he hasn't. Well, he's tried to. What else? Defunding Planned Parenthood. But he didn't. Not his fault again, the man said. More than anything, what seemed to upset the people I spoke with was the National Football League players who have knelt during the national anthem to protest police brutality and racial inequality. Shame on them, Del Signor, the catering company owner said. These clowns are out there making millions of dollars a year, and they're using some stupid excuse that they want equality, so I'll kneel against the flag and the national anthem? You're not a fan of equality, I asked. For people who deserve it and earn it, he said, all my ancestors, Italian, 100% Italian, the Irish, Germans, Polish, whatever, they all came over here, settled in places like this. They worked hard and they earned the success that they got. Some people don't want to do that. They just want it handed to them. Like NFL players, I said. Well, Del Signor responded, I hate to say what the majority of them are. He stopped himself short of what I thought he was about to say. Pam Schilling and her husband, however, did not restrain themselves. The thing that irritates me to no end is this NFL blank, Schilling told me in her living room. We do not watch no NFL now. Schilling looked at her husband, Dave McCabe, who's 67 and a retired high school basketball coach. She nodded at me. Tell him, she said to McCabe, what you said the NFL is. McCabe looked momentarily wary. He laughed a little. I don't remember saying that, he said unconvincingly. Schilling was having none of it. The NFL for life, Schilling said. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Politico.com. move into the health and science page. The lead article this week says, threshold for high blood pressure lowered. Health experts in the U.S. have tightened the official guidelines for what constitutes high blood pressure, a significant change that means 46% of American adults will now be above the threshold for what is considered safe. Hypertension, which damages blood vessels and causes the arteries to become clogged with plaque, was previously defined as 140 over 90 or higher. The first number represents the force that blood exerts on the artery walls when the heart contracts. The second reflects the same force between beats. After reviewing all existing evidence, a committee of experts appointed by the American Heart Association said the American College of Cardiology unanimously decided that the new cutoff should be 130 over 80. With that lower bar, an additional 31 million Americans will be deemed to have high blood pressure. The number of men under 45 who meet the diagnostic criterion will triple. The number of women who do so will double. Most of those newly diagnosed patients won't need medication, but the committee believes the reclassification will identify more accurately those at significant risk for heart attack, stroke, and other serious health issues, and serve as a wake-up call for people to exercise regularly, stop smoking, and make other healthy lifestyle adjustments. The risk hasn't changed, co-chairman Robert Carey tells the Washington Post. What's changed is our recognition of the risk. Exercise stops brain shrinkage. After people turn 40, their brain shrinks by about 5% every 10 years. But new research suggests aerobic exercise could have a protective effect, slowing this age-related deterioration and keeping the mind sharp over time. To investigate the effects of exercise on the hippocampus, a brain region essential for creating and storing memories, the international team of researchers analyzed 14 previous studies involving 737 people between ages 24 and 76. Some of the participants were healthy. Others suffered from Alzheimer's disease, depression, or schizophrenia. The researchers split the subjects into two groups: people who engaged in various fitness regimes for up to 2 years, and those who didn't exercise, and compared scans of their brains. They found that aerobic activity appeared to dramatically increase the size of the left region of the hippocampus. When you exercise, you produce a chemical called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, lead author Joseph Firth said from Western Sydney University. That may help to prevent age-related decline by reducing the deterioration of the brain. We're on the Talking Points page now. We'll start with an article called African Elephants: Should Trophy Ban Be Lifted? If you were an elephant, you might be puzzling over human behavior this week, said Virginia Morrill in TheAtlantic.com. First, the Trump administration unexpectedly announced it would lift an Obama-era ban on the import of elephant heads, tails, and other trophies brought back from Zimbabwe and Zambia by big game hunters. But when that decision sparked an uproar among animal rights activists, many of whom pointed out that President Trump's adult sons are, not coincidentally, avid big game hunters, Trump suddenly halted the decision pending a review. "Let's hope the trophy ban stays," said Maggie Shipstead in the New York Times. The African elephant population has plummeted from up to 10 million in 1930 to less than 500,000 today, mostly because poachers slaughtered vast numbers of the majestic animals for ivory and other body parts. Officials listed as threatened under the U.S. Endangered Species Act, the last thing elephants need is more people shooting at them. Big game hunting is an emotional subject, said Neil V. Battelle in Slate.com. But as counterintuitive as it sounds, lifting this ban could actually help save elephants. Wealthy Western hunters pay more than $30,000 for hunting excursions and up to $18,500 more for a trophy permit, money that can be poured back into local conservation efforts to protect elephant habitats and fight poaching. Animals, it is important to note, are not romanticized in Africa, said Monica Showalter in AmericanThinker.com. Elephants, lions, and other big game are viewed as either objects of terror or a much-needed source of local income. Without trophy hunters like Donald Jr., there would be no hunting industry, which pays many Africans wages, and no funding for anti-poaching efforts that protect the overall elephant population. But pay-to-slay programs only work if they're well-regulated, said Tony Norman in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. In Zimbabwe, hunting profits probably went straight into President Robert Mugabe's pocket. Corruption is endemic in the region. Overturning the hunting ban would be unconscionable. Elephants are wonderful creatures, remarkably gentle for their size, with high intelligence and complex social structures. Scientists have shown that elephants mourn, dream, and anticipate the future. Does the Trump administration really want to help rich men armed with high-powered rifles slaughter these gentle giants and then return home with the bloody proof of their manliness? And another article here, the nuclear button. What if Trump pushes it? Let's say that President Trump gets really mad one morning while watching Fox News and decides to launch a nuclear strike against North Korea. Would anything or anyone be able to stop him? Asked Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. The answer, it seems, is probably not. Last week, Congress held hearings to reexamine the nuclear chain of command, the first time it's done so in 41 years. The testimony was not comforting. To order an attack, officials and experts testified, all Trump has to do is call in the military officer who carries the, quote, football, the bulky briefcase containing the nuclear codes, and transmit launch orders to U.S. Strategic Command. A minute or so later, a barrage of nuclear missiles would be launched. Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee said the hearing wasn't designed to single out this president. But given Corker's well-publicized complaints about Trump's recklessness and instability, nobody was fooled. We did learn, however, that the military might not blindly follow a nuclear launch order, said Robert Burns and Richard Lardner in the Associated Press. The current head of Strategic Command, General John Hytum, later said that he would refuse a launch order from a president if he believed that order to be illegal, such as an unprovoked nuclear first strike. But Hytum admitted it was not clear what would happen then, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. Trump could simply circumvent any objecting general. In addition, military lawyers have compiled a book of legal justifications for almost any sort of nuclear attack that a president might want to order. That should concern us all, said Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune. Leaving complete authority to vaporize entire cities in the hands of one person has always been a risk. But it's truly alarming when that one person is so impulsive and vengeance-driven. Maybe it made sense to give the president total launch authority during the Cold War, when strategists worried that the Soviet Union, with thousands of missiles, would wipe out our entire nuclear arsenal with a surprise attack. But a rogue state like North Korea can't wipe out our arsenal. Democrats have introduced legislation requiring one president to get a declaration of war from Congress before ordering a first strike. For partisan reasons, the bill doesn't seem likely to pass. So for now, we'll have to hope that Trump won't succumb to the temptation to press the ultimate button. And we'll move to a few shorter pieces here. More than 4.7 million Americans, about 1.4% of the population, have registered so far this year for disaster aid from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, 10 times more than last year. The surge was caused by three hurricanes, Harvey, Irma, and Maria, and the Northern California wildfires. A North Korean soldier who was wounded while defecting to the South was riddled with parasites, some of them worms measuring 11 inches long. Doctors speculate that North Korea's food supply has become contaminated because of the widespread use of human excrement to fertilize crops. President Trump is tweeting more than ever. He sent 362 tweets in June, 424 in July, and 485 in September. At his current pace in November, his tweet tally will reach 723 by the end of the month. On one day alone, he shot off 51 tweets. More than 290 coaches and other officials associated with the United States Olympic sports organizations have been publicly accused of sexual misconduct since 1982. The figure spans 15 sports and amounts to an average of 8 adults connected to an Olympic organization accused of sexual misconduct every year for more than 36 years. We'll finish the hour with a longish quote. This comes from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I can't pronounce it. Sorry about that. Quoted in the New York Times. It's spelled Solzhenitsyn. And he says, "The line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart and through all human hearts." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138.